Now, the factory color said it was Bermuda sand, but everybody knew it was just pink.
Well, then the hill must be the strongest thing in the world.
And she looked at him with glittering eyes and she said, go ahead and try.
We love stories!
It's time for the apple seed, filled with stories for you and your family, all kinds of tales from all kinds of tellers. I'm Sam Payne, your host. And on today's episode, we're going to explore family relationships and what we learn in family relationships about being strong. It's going to be a great hour. And of course, because we know that the sharing of personal and family stories can sometimes be the spark that ignites memories for you that you can share with the people that you love around the kitchen table or the living room or the campfire, I'll share a memory of mine about a favorite album of my mom's and the lengths that my dad went to get her a copy of it. And because we know that great stories come into our lives in all kinds of ways, we'll have a conversation with our friend Don Shaline about a memory arising from a song. We're going to begin with a story from Catherine Conant from New Jersey. Catherine comes from a large Italian family. In that family, Catherine says, stories were the currency of everyday life. Catherine weaves together all the excitement and anxiety of what it was like to learn how to drive in this story, recorded live at the Timpanogos Storytelling Festival, largest storytelling festival in the West, and for more than 30 years has been bringing great stories and great storytellers to the stage. Here's Catherine Conant on the Appleseed.
My dad loved cars. No, I mean, he loved cars. In 1936, he drove from Perth Amboy, New Jersey to Indianapolis, Indiana, for the races. Took him 2.5 days to get there, 2.5 days to get back. He had 14 hours at the races. Said it was the best 14 hours he ever had in his life. When I was growing up, my father cherished cars, and in his life, he owned Fords, Chevys, Buicks, Oldsmobiles, Mercurys, Thunderbirds, Lincolns, Cadillacs, and sadly, once briefly, a Nash. Every car that he got, he treated it as if it was one of a kind. Washed, waxed, polished, buffed, until the day came when he saw a different make and a different model. And within a week, that old car was gone and the new one was in its place. Every Saturday, wash, wax, buff, polish. Loved to do it. When I was starting high school, he bought a 1959 Mercury Monterey. It was a sedan. It was 18 feet long. It was 6 feet, 7 inches wide. It had a V8 315 horsepower engine. It had three options you could buy: power steering, power brakes, or a push button radio. Now, the factory color said it was Bermuda sand. But everybody knew it was just pink. It weighed 4,000 pounds. Every Saturday morning, my father and I would wash, wax, buff, polish, vacuum. I was in charge of the chrome fenders and hubcaps and the 4-inch white walls. When I was old enough to get my license, my father said he had seen enough destruction during the war and he was not going to watch me wreck his car. So it became my mom's job. Now, Mom was a good driver, but she was an anxious driver. And when we would go out together, as I would drive down the street, if she thought I was edging too close into the center of the street, she would grab the wheel and yank it towards the curb. I would immediately yank it back in the other direction. So anybody following us noticed a certain zigzag pattern to my driving. But eventually, the state of New Jersey said I was a fully licensed motor vehicle operator. The problem became getting my hands on the car. My father was very protective. If I ever took it out, he checked the mileage before I left. He checked the mileage when I came back, just in case I was wasting miles someplace he didn't approve of. Eventually, I figured out the way to do it. Wait until Friday night after a long week of work, he's stretched out on the couch watching TV, and then I would just go in and say, "Daddy, Daddy, Judy and Patty and I want to have a sleepover at my house here. Could you just drive over and pick them up?" And he would say, "Take the car." Worked every time. Now, in order to pick up my two friends, I had to go out and travel down Woodbridge Avenue. Woodbridge Avenue was actually the western edge of the Raritan Arsenal, 3,232 acres of prime New Jersey wasteland that the U.S. Army had used as a vehicle and ordnance storage for World War I and World War II. Woodbridge Avenue was long, straight, no streetlights, and not even a traffic light until you got all the way to the end to a little hamlet called Bonham Town, where there was a church, half a dozen houses, and the school bus garage. Well, I drove on down one hot Saturday night to pick them up. I first got Judy, and then I got Patty, and then because by that time it had been at least 3 hours since we had had anything to eat, we went over to the Leaning Tower of Pizza so that I could show off the car. We headed back towards my house, and when we got to the Bonham Town light, it was red. It was almost never red. So we just waited. Judy was in the front seat, Patty was in the back. And as we sat at the light, a car pulled up beside me in the turn lane. It was a car full of genuine pompadour wearing, black leather jacket, Elvis wannabe bad boys. It was Jackie Fielding and Petey Grimes, and in the back, their little toady Gary Marchling. If I had been able to see into the future, I would have realized that Jackie went on to have a successful manufacturing career making license plates for the state of New Jersey. Petey had a successful but tragically brief career in short-term loan collection for his Uncle Vito. Nobody ever knew what happened to Gary, but nobody really cared. They were in Jackie's car. It was legendary. It was a 1950 Ford, black, flathead engine, 312 horsepower. It had been nosed, which means they took the hood ornaments off of it, painted a sleek, dark black. It had headers, glass pack mufflers, and dual exhausts. It had been chopped and channeled, which meant they lowered the roof and raised the floor with big black skirts that almost completely covered the rear wheels. And I sat there at the light, and I looked at that and them, and I thought, that is everything in the world I have been told to avoid under any circumstances. Speed, risk, disregarding the rules, having fun, black leather. Petey squinted over at me and said, "Hey." I said, "Hello." Suddenly, Jackie stepped on the accelerator and his car went. I do not know who actually stepped on the accelerator. I have no recollection of it. But since I was sitting behind the wheel, it must have been me. And I heard my father's Mercury go vroom, vroom, and the light changed. We took off, headed down Woodbridge Avenue. Patty's in the back seat, pounding on my shoulders, yelling, "Go, go, go!" I look over at Judy. She's sitting bolt upright, her eyes wide open. I thought, she looks like she's had an accident. Oh, I hope she hasn't had an accident. And then I realized I was keeping up. I wasn't winning yet, but I was keeping up. And I saw those lights in the rear view mirror. Jackie saw him too, floored it, and was gone. I pulled over. We were absolutely silent. A patrolman came up, leaned down and said, "License and registration, please." I reached over in the glove compartment and I took out the registration, and then I dug down into my purse for that little scrap of paper that was going to be my ticket to independence, and I handed it over to the man. He walked back to his patrol car. Patty's on her back in the back seat going, "I'm never gonna get into a decent college. My mother's gonna kill me." I looked over at Judy. She hadn't moved. Her eyes were open, her mouth was open. I wasn't sure she was breathing. And the patrolman came back, leaned down and said, "Are you Bill Caristi's daughter?" "Uh-huh." "Your father sold me my house." "Huh. He said, your dad loves his cars." "Uh-huh." "I bet he doesn't know you're drag racing, does he?" And got real close and said, "You listen to me. I better not ever catch you drag racing again. Do you believe me?" "Uh-huh. He handed me back the paper and walked back to his car, turned it around and drove away. Judy opened the car door, stood up and threw up. Patty's in the back seat moaning, "I have to go home. Please let me go home. I just have to go home." And I carefully drove them both home and then drove back down Woodbridge Avenue, parked the car. I was late, pulled into the garage, went in the house, put the keys on the counter. My dad was still up. "What's up? Huh? What happened? You're late. What's going on?"
Patty got sick and she threw up."
"In my car? Did she throw up in my car?"
No, outside on the ground, so I took him home."
"Oh, all right, fine. Gunsmoke's on, you wanna watch?" "Nope." I think I'm just gonna go on upstairs." He said, "Okay. Don't forget, tomorrow, wash and wax." Yeah, wash and wax. And as I started to climb the stairs, it occurred to me he was never going to know. And he never did. I went in my bedroom, I closed the door, I sat down, and I thought, "Ha! I was drag racing with Jackie Fielding. And I could have won. And I will never do that again."
Catherine Conant in a performance recorded live at the Timpanogos Storytelling Festival. Find more about the festival at timpfest.org. They've long been supporters of the Appleseed. We're grateful for their support. Coming up, we've got an entry in the Radio Family Journal. That's coming up. I'm Sam Bain.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed. Before the break, a story told for you by Catherine Conant, recorded live at the Timpanogos Storytelling Festival. In just a moment, a conversation with our friend Don Shaline about a memory arising from an old song. But before that, how about an entry in the Radio Family Journal?
The Radio Family Journal with Sam Payne. A tiny little story for you and your family. Right when you need it, on The Appleseed.
My dad was never a guy who was super interested in stuff. Having stuff, I mean. Except for a pretty dense collection of fine guitars, he's lived a pretty Spartan life when it comes to stuff. His cars have always been secondhand. His clothes are often from thrift stores. He's always joked that you can tell a lot about him from the fact that his clothes are from thrift stores while his guitars are from C.F. Martin. It's never really been about stuff for my dad. It's not really anti-materialism, I don't think. It's just sort of non-materialism. And that sort of karma comes back to him from time to time. One of the stories in the family canon of stories is a little tale about a time when my dad was hired to play music at a Christmas party at a big fancy house. And he did his thing and then left the party in the middle of a snowstorm. He couldn't see a thing. And he climbed into the old Ford Econoline van that was the family car all the time I was a kid, and he backed up the van, maneuvering to get out of the driveway, and he heard a sickening crunch. And he stopped the van and climbed out, and through the swirling snow, he could just make out what it is that he's hit. It's a brand new Corvette, one of the cars owned by one of the guests at the party. And he just put a big dent in it. Well, with his heart in his socks, he slogged back into the party, and he doesn't even know whose Corvette it is. So he had to ask around until he found the right guy. And then he swallowed and described what happened, and the guy just waved him off. He said, "Don't worry about it. It's just a material thing." And my dad headed back out into the snow, saved. I mean, what are the chances, right? Well, maybe it was just as well that my dad wasn't over-interested in stuff. My dad bought a nice pair of shoes once, and I drew all over them with a green marker. And it was probably good for my own well-being that he didn't care even more about those shoes than he did. The truth is, I only ever saw my dad really freak out over the loss of a thing, a material item, one time in my whole life. There was a piece of music that my mother loved. It was a suite called The Faithful Shepherd. It was written by Handel in 1712. And the story told by the music speaks of a long-ago, faraway place where each year a virgin must be sacrificed to the goddess Diana. And the oracle has decreed that this punishment can only be lifted by the marriage of a specific boy and girl. And they know who the boy and girl are. So their fathers arrange a marriage between them. Super cheerful, right? I know. But it's a beautiful piece of music. And my mother loved it, especially the recording made in 1940 by Sir Thomas Beecham and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, the album with the green cover with the black triangle on it, the one with the weird gold medal in the corner. It was the landmark recording of the Faithful Shepherd Suite, and it was old enough and tough enough to find that it was a real blessing when, by chance, playing an out-of-town gig, my dad wandered into a record store, flipped through a bin of LPs, and gasped. There it was. The green cover with the black triangle on it, the weird gold medal in the corner, the 1940 Beecham recording of the Faithful Shepherd Suite, the only copy he'd seen in years. Well, he bought it and brought it home as a gift for my mom. And, long story short, about 3 weeks later, he went to put that album on the record player, and the face of it was all scratched up, unplayable. None of us copped to the crime, but it had to be one of us kids, just not being careful with those vinyl records. And it's true, we sometimes weren't very careful. Sometimes we'd put a record on the turntable on top of another record. It makes me shudder now, of course, but then, well, we were kids. But that record... Whenever I try to imagine hopelessness and anger and sadness, I think on the day my dad put that record on the turntable after we'd wrecked it. None of us ever wanted to see our dad like that again. He wasn't violent or dangerous. It's just that we never wanted to be in the same room with so much sadness, so much disappointment. Never again, if we could help it. I know better than to believe that it was the loss of the actual vinyl object that my dad was lamenting. The object was just the vehicle for the miracle of having music in our home, having that music in our home. And the rarity of the find, that had something to do with it too, of course. I gotta say that as a grown-up in an era of eBay, I looked that album up and bought a copy for my mom for her birthday. These days it's not hard to find at all, and not expensive either. As it turns out, my mom didn't remember the Faithful Shepherd Suite all that well. To make it meaningful, I had to tell her the story I just told you. And you know how I feel about that, the kind of sharing of family memories, tragedies and adventures and triumphs and failures, the memories that bind us together. That, as they say, is the stuff.
The Radio Family Journal of Sam Payne, a tiny little story for you and your family, right when you need it, on the Appleseed.
Thanks for joining me for that entry in the Radio Family Journal. We always hope that the stories that we bring you here on the show spark memories and thoughts for you that you can share with the people that you love. If they're doing that, you can send us an email. Share your story with us at theappleseed@byu.edu. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up, a lot more, Bobby Norfolk, Lynn Ford, and Donna Washington. But first, a conversation with a friend. Great stories come into our lives in so many ways, through the telling of tales around kitchen tables and in living rooms and around campfires, to the great books that we choose to digest late at night or whenever we've got a spare moment, bringing some of those great stories into our lives, and certainly through the songs that we hear. Those musical cues can spark memories and thoughts for us that are a pleasure to share with the people that we love. And to talk a little bit about a memorable song, I've got Don Schaline. Don Schaline, it's such a pleasure to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Sam. I love this. You know, you really think about it, music can be your own custom-made soundtrack. That's how I look
at it. It sure can.
You know, turn that thing on and you get all kinds of moods and memories and things like that. But
you know, there was a time, certainly as you talk about that, I think about all of us have sort of walked around wondering what the soundtrack of our life might be, you know, and wishing that some of these emotional moments, if somebody made a movie, how would it be scored? And it used to be that in order to hear music, we had to really sort of go to a lot of effort. You know, we had to go to where the record player was and we had to put on a record and we had to sit down there. These days, you can almost have an underscored life. Pop in some headphones and go about your day, you know. But yeah, the song we're going to talk about today is a particular part of the soundtrack of your life, right?
It sure is. I was a fan of Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young when they came out. And I remember when I first heard their early stuff, I wasn't quite sure who any of these people were. I didn't realize that, and I'd liked Buffalo Springfield and the Byrds before and didn't know that these were people from there. But as you know, they had a very turbulent, very stellar and turbulent career, up and down and up and down and break up and get back together. And in the first breakup after CSN and Y, they all did their solo albums. And about this time, I was heading off to college, went to Utah State University up in Logan. And my very favorite part of my college years up at Utah State was working at KUSU, the FM rock radio station that they had up there. In those days, you just kind of grabbed whatever album was on the shelf and played it. And it was very fun because it was like discovering new things. Hey, here, audience, we're going to discover something together. You know, who knows? It could have been horrible. But fortunately, there were some real gems in there, too. And one of those was Stephen Stills had just released his solo album. A cut on the album was called We Are Not Helpless. And coming out of that era, the Vietnam War had been wearing on, protests, lots and lots of turbulence had been happening around the nation. It felt very fractured, very tenuous, and kind of like, is this nation going to survive? This is 1972.
Yeah.
You know, I put on this song, and it starts very quietly, just a simple Stephen Stills on a guitar saying, we are not helpless. Hmm. And even now, as I think about it, I start getting a little choked up because it just has this feeling of, hey, we can do this. And he starts singing that and the band comes in. And then the gospel singers come in and it's this revival. And then he gets into this rave up in the middle where it's just, you know, gospel revival. Yeah. And then this blasting big ending. And for me, it just was like, I need this right now. I need a little bit of this reaffirmation that we can handle this. Yeah. We all are, and here's a line from it. All are strangers, all are friends, all are brothers.
Let's hear a little bit of that tune, shall we?
We are not helpless, we are men. What lies between us? It can be set aside and ended. Every day we learn more how to hate. Shut the door. And then we tell ourselves we can't relate. Only to the one.
You know, as I listen to you talk about this, one of the things I love is imagining you putting that record on at the radio station, you know, in an environment, there were radio station experiences where, as you said, you know, you as the DJ and your audience could all kind of discover something together, you know, and in a world in those days when everybody is experiencing something kind of monumental and something kind of disorienting and something that with which a lot of emotion is associated, and then you and your audience sort of discovering together this tune that gives words to the emotions and feelings that not only are you having, but everyone in your audience is having too. And even though you're alone in that radio booth, you find yourself in this moment of sharing with your audience, right?
Right. Yeah. I love that about music, and especially that kind of music, the kind of music that, yeah, there are some dark things, there are troubles, but we can do this. I love music that reaffirms the human condition of resilience.
And boy, you know, you have talked about being having kind of a deep knowledge of a few decades worth of music.
Yeah.
And that's the fingerprint of that decade, isn't it? I mean, that's we were learning to say in popular music in that era some things, you know, some really important things.
Yeah, and you will know this very well, that over and over, musical critics tended to lambast that.
Yeah, right, yeah.
They tended to really make fun of the wide-eyed innocence, the protest songs and the various things that kind of said, why are we doing this? Let's be better. Let's, you know.
Yeah.
Critics tended to really have a field day with that kind of thing, and that's okay. The rest of us that liked listening to it and had their own personal message of what this meant to us, we were just fine with it.
Yeah, yeah. As you talk, I'm just thinking about how great stories, and it's true of great songs as well, tend to give us the words that we sometimes can't find ourselves. What a pleasure it's been to chat with Don Shaline about this great tune. Don, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Great stories come into our lives in all kinds of ways. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with stories from, Bobby Norfolk. We're going to hear a story from him called Three Strong Women that you won't want to miss. Lynn Ford's going to tell us a story. We'll wrap up with Donna Washington. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed. Before the break, a conversation with our friend Don Shaline about a memory arising from an old song. Is there a song that you can think of that sparks a memory for you? You might want to share that memory with somebody that you love around the kitchen table or the living room. That's what we're all about here on The Appleseed. Coming up, a story called Three Strong Women, a story told for you by Bobby Norfolk about three women so strong that when they come across a professional wrestler, they're able to teach him a thing or two from a collection called Baby Hawk Learns to Fly, stories about purpose, patience, confidence, and courage. Here's Three Strong Women from Bobby Norfolk.
Once there was this professional wrestler. Oh, he stood 6 foot 6 and weighed over 390 pounds. And as this big, huge wrestler was walking through the mountains, boom, 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 he was on his way to the professional wrestling match. And as he was walking down this long road, all of a sudden he looked down and there was a creek. And at the bottom of that hill was a young girl. Well, this young girl was dipping up a bucket of water from the creek, and she put the bucket of water upon her head and started to amble back up onto the road. And as this big, huge wrestler who knew no equal, boom, 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 look, he saw the young girl and he thought to himself, I bet if I walk up behind that young girl and tickle her up under her arm, coochie coochie coo, she would drop that bucket of water, and then I can be the big man that I am, humble as I am, and go get her some more water. And so, the big wrestler tiptoed behind the young girl, as if a 390-pound man can tiptoe, and he took his hand and he put it up under her arm and he said, coochie coochie coo, and whoo! And a quick jerk reaction, she brought her arm down and his hand was caught between her body and her arm. The big wrestler was, I see you caught me, young girl. That's very good of you to take a joke so humorously. And as he tried to withdraw his hand, she wouldn't let it go. And he said, young lady, you better let me go. I'm a big, strong wrestler and I am on my way to wrestle in the professional tournament. So I may hurt you if I pull too hard. And she looked at him with glittering eyes, and she said, go ahead and try to withdraw your hand. I love a strong man. The wrestler said, well, you asked for it, young lady. And he pulled, and he pulled, and she just ambled her way back on down the road, pulling him along like a young puppy dog. And all of a sudden, the wrestler began to break down. Let me go, you're hurting my hand. I'm a professional wrestler, and I hope nobody is watching this. And she said, you call yourself a big, strong wrestler. I'll make you a deal. I will take you up on top of the mountain, and I will introduce you to my ma and my grandmama. And we will pump you up to make you a professional wrestler as we know you truly can be. And so what choice did this wrestler have but to agree to the young lady's proposition? And so he agreed, and she then opened up her arm from her body, and his hand was now swollen about 3 times its normal size, throbbing. He dipped it into the creek to cool it off. And she said, okay, now you follow me, because if you change your mind and try to sneak off, we will hunt you down like the dog you are. He agreed. Well, as they went on up into the valley where the young girl lived, he looked off into the distance, and there was a woman off in the distance carrying something on her shoulder. And as the professional wrestler began to fix his gaze, he looked, and the woman had a full-grown cow on her shoulder. And as the wrestler began to look at this woman, the woman said, oh, honey, I see you brought us a visitor. Yes, Mama, this is a professional wrestler, and he's going off to wrestle in the professional tournament. Oh, she lifted up the cow and put it to the ground. Bloom. The wrestler said, madam, why did you have that cow on your shoulder? Oh, well, it's a cow that has trouble with her hooves walking on top of the rocks, and I just wanted her to eat the grass up in the high mountains and then bring her down without hurting her hooves. The professional wrestler was beginning to think twice about his proposition. And as these three people were now headed for the cabin, all of a sudden an old woman, had to be at least 97 years old, started walking out of the cabin. And this old woman was all bent over and she said, oh, hi, I see you brought us a visitor, honey. And the middle woman said, oh, that's my grandmama. And the old woman tripped on the root. Oh, I'm sick of this stump being here. And the old woman put her cane down and she grabbed that big tree stump by both arms and she pulled and she pulled and she pulled. All of a sudden, crunch, the entire stump came out of the ground and the root system was hanging down. The old woman reared back and she threw that stump. Woo! Plop! Landed 500 yards away. The old woman said, I wanted to throw it over the mountain, honey. I went to throw it over the mountain. And the youngest girl said, my grandmama, I will throw it over the mountain. And that young girl took that stump and she whished it through the air. It went out of sight and over the last crest of the mountain, and at the same time, the wrestler dropped to the ground in a dead faint. Well, when they finally revived the old boy, they trained him for about 3 long weeks, and he ate all the food that they had to give him. And all this time, he was using the old woman as his trainer, because nobody else could train with the wrestler. The youngest girl was too strong for him, so was the mother. The only one that was capable of wrestling with this guy without hurting him too badly was the old woman. Well, as they trained and wrestled, this wrestler began to learn something called humility. Well, at the end of the 3-week period, the wrestler was ready. And what he said, "If I win first prize, I will bring you ladies back a present." And they said, "Ah, we shall see. You do the best you can, young man, and we'll talk later," said the old woman. Well, the professional wrestler went off, and all of these other wrestlers were there bragging and walking about, strutting like peacocks and spitting tobacco all over the place. And the professional wrestler sat down in a lotus position and did some slow, deep breathing and centered himself. The other wrestlers looked at, "What's wrong with him? Must have had too much to drink last night." They did not know that he had found a new centering of strength. Well, as the referee stepped into the ring, the professional wrestler was the first one. He stepped into the ring too. His opponent weighed about twice as much as he did, stood about another 2 feet taller. Well, his opponent looked at him and they gave each other the tiger's eye. Well, what happened was that when that referee said, "Let the games begin," all of a sudden, our professional wrestler gave that guy a hip toss, a body slam, the suplex, a spinning step over toe hold, arm drag and a toss, the flying mare, the back body drop, the Olympic stretch, the figure four grapevine, the iron claw, the stomach claw. Woo! He took that guy, whirled him around like a baton and threw him outside the ring. Woo! Plop! The opponent got up and limping away. Oh, God. He looked like Chester walking away. And as he walked away, he said, "I don't think I'm going to wrestle anymore today." Well, all the other wrestlers were now having second thoughts about this, too. And one other guy way in the back said, "I'll wrestle that bum. He can't do that to me." Well, he spit that last drop of tobacco out of his mouth, stepped into the ring, and before you knew it, he was landing on his neck, too. They had to bring in 3-4 medics to take care of this old boy. And after that, all these wrestlers were huddled in a corner somewhere wondering, "What manner of man is this?" Well, as it turns out, the judges had made a decision. They said, "We're going to announce by default that our wrestler here in the ring, our first number one wrestler, wins the first prize. Nobody else will wrestle the old boy. He had to be the winner." And so after that, they gave him the first prize, and the first prize was a big old sack of gold. He just threw it over his back just like you would have some feathers, maybe in a sack. And he took that big sack of gold back into the mountains, and he saw those three ladies. He said, "Ladies, guess what? You pumped me up just right. I won first prize." Well, as he handed that sack of gold to the ladies and said, "Y'all can have half of this," and they retorted, "But we don't take money from strangers." He said, "Well, if you won't take my money, can I have your daughter's hand in marriage?" he said to the mother. Well, they thought about it for about 5 seconds, and then they said in unison, "Yes!" Well, that young girl went off and got her a nice dress. The wrestler went off and had him a special made tuxedo. They sent out 3,000 invitations, got one myself. And they had the biggest wedding that you would ever see in these parts of the United States. And guess what? That wrestler, his wife, and all his in-laws lived very happily ever after.
Bobby Norfolk with a story called 3 Strong Women here on the Appleseed. Find out more about Bobby's great work at his website, bobbynorfolk.com. Apple Seed.com. Coming up, a story told for you by Lynn Ford. This is a story called The Strongest Thing in the World. It's a story about a little boy in search of the strongest thing in the world, never realizing that the strongest thing in the world might be something he can't easily see. This is a story told for you by Lynn Ford, and we're happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed.
Once there was a boy who wanted to be the strongest thing in the world. He didn't even know what that might mean, but it sounded like a good thing. If I was the strongest thing in the world, everybody would have to look up to me. They'd all like me. I'd really be somebody special. If I could be stronger than anyone, if I could be the strongest thing in the world. Well, the boy tried to think of strong things from which he might learn. If he could find a strong thing that could teach him how to be strong, then maybe he could be even stronger than that thing. Maybe he could truly become the strongest thing in the world. The boy watched as his father chipped away at a stone, making another sculpture. His father cut the stone just as his grandfather had, just as his great-grandfather had. His great-grandfather. Now, his great-grandfather had been born underneath a tall, strong tree, and that tree still stood in the front yard. That tree has been standing around since before my great-grandfather was born, said the boy. Maybe that old tree is the strongest thing in the world. And so he ran to the tree and looked up into its old branches that still held beautiful young green leaves. The boy called out, "Tree! Oh, tree! Are you the strongest thing in the world?" The branches moved, and the tree said, "Me? The strongest thing in the world? No. For even as I stand here now, the wind begins to blow. And when it blows hard enough, it may blow me right over. The wind blows leaves from my branches. It blows branches to the ground. No, the wind is stronger than I." "The wind is stronger than you are?" said the boy. "Then I must talk to the wind." And the boy ran until he felt the wind blowing against his cheeks. Then the boy stopped and called out, "Wind, oh wind, are you the strongest thing in the world? You must be, because you can blow over my great-grandfather's tree." And the wind blew. "Who do you think I am? The strongest thing in the world? Oh, no," said the wind. "For the hill on which you stand can stop me from blowing altogether. I cannot blow through this hill. The hill is stronger than I."
"The hill is stronger than you?" said the boy.
"Well, then the hill must be the strongest thing in the world." And so the boy looked down at the soft green grass growing around his feet, and the boy called out, "Hill, oh hill, are you the strongest thing in the world? Because you can stop the wind that will blow down my great-grandfather's tree, so you must be the strongest thing in the world."
The hill said, "Huh, me? No, I don't think so, because you see, the river that starts as a stream here, well, it washes away the dirt on either side of it. It makes stones roll down my sides. If the river can wash parts of me away, then the river must be stronger than I."
"The river? The river can wash away the hill? Well, then the river must be the strongest thing in the world.
Well, the boy ran down the hill, following the stream until it flowed into a great river. And the boy stood on the riverbank and called out, "River! River! Are you the strongest thing in the world? You must be, because you wash away the hill that stops the wind that will blow down my great-grandfather's tree. So you must be the strongest thing in the world." The river said, "Blah, blah, 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 blah. Nope. I'm not the strongest thing in the world. For you see, the stones that sit at the bottom of me have been sitting there for years and years and years. Now, I can wear them down, blah, 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 blah. But they never seem to go away. And so the stones are stronger than I." "The stones at the bottom of the river are stronger than the river itself," said the boy. "Then the stones must be the strongest thing in the world." And so the boy ran farther down the river to a place where the stones seemed to rise right up out of the water and settle on both sides of that moving, strong thing. And the boy called out, "Stones! Oh, stones! Hello, stones!" Well, the stones were the strong and silent type. It took a long time for the stones to answer. Finally, the stones said, "Boy, what do you want?" "Stones," asked the boy, "are you the strongest things in the world? For you sit at the bottom of the river and never seem to disappear. A river that can wash away a hill that stops the wind that will blow down my great-grandfather's tree. Stones, you must be the strongest things in the world." But the stones said, "No, we are not the strongest. We are very slow to act. One day the river will have washed some of us away. And your father, he comes and chooses from among us. He takes us to his workshop, and there he chips away at us. Your father cuts the stones and turns them into beautiful sculptures. Your father and his tools are stronger than any stone." My father can cut the stones. The stones that sit in the river that wears down the hill that stops the wind that will blow down my great-grandfather's tree, my father can break stone? Well, then my father is the strongest thing in the world," said the boy. And he ran from the stones back along the river, up over the hill, down where the wind blew at the great tree his great-grandfather had known. "Father," said the boy as he ran, "Father, I'm so happy. You have to teach me how to be strong. After all, you are the strongest thing in the world." Father said, "Not really." "What?" said the boy. "Oh, no, no, no. I am not the strongest thing in the world. My goodness, there are many things that are much stronger than I. But I have knowledge. I have learned how to chip away at this stone. And the patience that I learned as I chipped away at it, well, it has helped me to gain wisdom. I know that I can learn from many, many things and many, many people. And if I pass my knowledge and my wisdom on to you, then it will show you how much you are loved, my son. And love, well, if there's anything stronger, I don't know about it. Love, I think, is the strongest thing in the world, my son. And you already have a great deal of love." "I have a great deal of love," said the boy. "And someday I will know as much as you, and I will be wise, because you love me, and my mother loves me, and my grandparents love me, and my great-grandparents love me, I have all that love. Well, then I'm already the strongest thing in the world, said the boy. And he skipped away happily, knowing something that all the world should know. The strongest thing in all the world is love. That's the end of that story. That's the end of my stories. Please take some of them with you and let them rest under your pillow.
The Strongest Thing in the World, a story told for you by Lynn Ford. Find out more about Lynn's great storytelling work at storytellerlynnford.com. We're going to wrap up with a story from the great storyteller Donna Washington. This is a story of a bear who knows how to look good and dress well, but doesn't always listen to his friends, even when his friends want what's best for him. He'll learn a lesson, and you'll get a laugh in the story of Handsome Bear, told for you by Donna Washington on the Appleseed.
There was once a bear who thought himself a real handsome devil. Every morning he'd get up and brush his fur till it shined. And then he would say, "Huh, you're a real handsome devil." Well, it happened that there was to be a fair in a town right near where the bear lived, and he decided he was going to go. He got up in the morning and brushed his fur until it squeaked. Then he put on his best trousers, his best jacket, his high top hat, and his shiny black boots, picked up his walking stick, stood in the mirror and said, "Huh, you are one handsome devil." He went on down the road towards the town. Before he got about halfway there, he heard a sound. "Gah, where you going? Gah, where you going? Gah, where you going?" Now, the bear looked up and there was a crow. Not a very attractive crow at that, the bear thought. He had beady little eyes, and his feathers were sort of covered in dust, and his pointy, pointy beak. No, he was not very attractive at all. The bear decided not to listen to him. He said, "I'm going to the fair so everyone can see that I am a very handsome devil." And he tried to get away so he wouldn't have to listen to anything else, the crow said. But the crow said, "Gah, like that? Gah! You'll be the laughing stock of the whole fair! Gah!" The bear stopped. "What do you mean? I'm always fashionably dressed." The crow said, "Well, caw, then you've missed fashion, caw. Fashion has changed, caw." The bear said, "Well, come, what do you mean? What fashion has changed?" "Well," said the crow, "people are not wearing trousers anymore. No, caw, no, pants are out, caw." "What are they wearing?" asked the bear. "Plastic bags, caw, that's what they're wearing, yes, caw." Well, plastic bags, yep, yep. "Well, what else?" "Well, people are not wearing jackets anymore. Gah, no, gah." "Well, what are they wearing?" "Paper bags. Gah, yep, paper bags, gah." "Paper bags. And what else, Mr. Crow? Please tell me, dear Crow, what else are they wearing?" "Well, gah, they're not wearing shoes anymore. Gah, certainly not boots, gah. They're wearing shoeboxes." "Yep, that's right, shoeboxes, gah. And people are not wearing hats on their heads. No, God, no. They're wearing frying pans." The bear said, "Thank you. Thank you so much. I would have gone to the fair looking like a fool." He ran straight home. He took off his trousers and threw them into a corner. He took off his jacket and threw it on top of his trousers. He pulled off his boots and he threw his hat into the corner. Then he got out the biggest plastic bag he could find. He cut out some holes for his legs, put on the plastic bag, used a little rope to tie it around his waist. He got out a great big paper bag, cut out some holes for his arms, a hole for his head, and struggled into it. He got out the biggest shoe boxes he could find, put them on his feet, and took some string and tied it across the top so they wouldn't come off. And then he got out the biggest, blackest frying pan he had, shined it up, and stuck it on his head. He looked in the mirror and he said, "You are one handsome devil." And then he went on down the road. When he got to the town, all the people were laughing and playing games and riding on rides. And then all the noise stopped. And he realized they were looking at him. He thought it was because he looked so good, so he posed. And then he heard it. Would you look at that ridiculous bear? Laughter erupted from everyone's throat. The bear tried to figure out what ridiculous bear they were talking about. He kept looking around, and then he realized it was him. No one else had a frying pan on their head. He turned around, embarrassed, and began running back towards his home. As he went through the forest, those shoeboxes flopping around on his feet, he tripped. That frying pan hit him dead in the head. Bong! When he hit the ground. And then he heard, ga, 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 ga. He looked up, and there was the crow. Ga, 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 ga. The bear stood up and said, how could you do this to me? You told me people were wearing frying pans and paper bags and plastic bags and shoe boxes. How could you do this to me? And the crow said, ga, I told you many things, ga, but I never once said I was telling the truth. Ga, 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 ga. And he flew off. That story is a fable, my friends, and it has a moral, and the moral is this. Don't believe everything you hear. And that is the story of Handsome Bear.
The story of Handsome Bear from Donna Washington. A pleasure to bring you that story, as well as stories from Lynn Ford, Bobby Norfolk, and Catherine Conant, and a conversation with our friend Don Shaline about a memory arising from an old song. Plenty of opportunity for you to share memories and thoughts with the people that you love. You can find us online at byuradio.org/appleseed or Google the Appleseed podcast for something new just about every day on the show. This hour was written by Samantha Daines. Our audio engineer is Carly Robison. Our producer, Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne. Can't wait to be with you again on The Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by The Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.